more week to go through various issues next week as well. Today we're looking to hear about the state economic situation and forecast, and also a lottery overview. First off, we'll be hearing from Tom Petowski, the state economist with the Office of Economic Analysis, and senior economist Mike Kennedy. And then during the lottery overview, we expect to hear from Dale Penn, the lottery director. So, Mr. Petowski and Mr. Kennedy, come forward.
Did you see him?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Ways and Means Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Petowski, State Economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. With me today is Senior Economist Michael Kennedy, who will cover the revenue section. What I'd like to start off with is just a very quick, less than even 10 minutes, give you sort of an overview from our office and our economic outlook, and then spend the majority of our time talking about the revenue outlook. Our office is just barely a little over 20 years old. It was formed in 1980, most likely at the time at the result of very tough economic times in the state and very tough budgetary times, and a desire to have an office that could more carefully look at what revenues were doing and how the economy was operating. We're housed in the Department of Administrative Services, and the main function which still exists today is to generate quarterly state economic and revenue outlooks. The first forecast was released in May of 1981, and we release quarterly forecasts on the economy and revenues during the first month of each in each quarter, March, June, May 15th will be our release for this legislative session, and then September and December. We have three advisory committees that help us: the Council of Economic Advisors, a Department of Administrative Services Advisory Committee, and then recently a Council of Revenue Forecast Advisors, which are mostly made up of tax accountants, CPAs, tax advisors, people from businesses. Also, Department of Revenue are members, and also from the Legislative Revenue Office, there are members of this committee to advise us. besides those functions just mentioned, we do a number of other functions that were added to the office: population forecasts, population surveys, prison inmate forecasts, lottery revenue forecasts. We also manage the highway cost allocation study. This gives a quick schematic of what we go through each quarter on our forecast. We first devise the economic forecast, and it's the economic forecast then that in turn drives the revenue forecast. We've also added a new function to help us forecasting. We've devised our own leading economic indicator for Oregon. These are some of the items that go into the Oregon leading economic indicator. As an example, the Oregonian Help Wanted Index on the bottom there, the presumption is that if the index starts to go up, we should start to see employment going up in the future, and vice versa.
This is interesting, and that's a little bit of a new feature. Why were those particular indicators chosen? Is that what other states do? Where did they come from?
Mr. Chair, these are a combination of what other states have also used, and also at the national level, because some national figures do, you know, affect us right here in Oregon. And then we have a few that are very specific to Oregon. For example, of all the ones we surveyed, no other state uses the semiconductor book-to-bill ratio as a component. But for us, that would make sense to be a component because of our concentration of semiconductor firms.
Very good. Thank you.
Senator Westland.
Well, and I guess as a follow-up to Senator Schrader's question, how often or what's the chronology of the how many times we've changed the matrix, the equation of our leading economic indices?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, this was just devised. It's barely a year old right now, and so we haven't changed any of these components. But as an example, here's the chart. We use this as a complement to our econometric modeling that we use for the state. plus along with our advisory committees to see what's going on. So I don't know if that answers
it. So, I mean, what I heard you to say was you were changing the variables in the leading economic indicators.
Oh.
Did I miss here?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Westland. These are, many states have a leading economic indicator.
Right, and so does Oregon, and we have had them for a number of years, correct?
Like I said, this leading economic indicator was just built about a year ago.
This one?
This one.
How many times have we changed the variables?
We've not changed the variables.
Ever?
Ever. These have been the same variables from the start.
That's the answer to my question.
Okay. Senator Morissette.
Thank you. What's, as a new member, the Atlanta federal dollar index look like?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, the Atlanta federal dollar index is a composite of various exchange rates with the dollar, and it tends to concentrate a little bit more on the Pacific Rim area. So we like to use that one as a weighted average of the trade-weighted exchange rate as an aspect for Oregon. The idea being that if we should see the U.S. dollar falling slightly in value relative to our trading partners, that should encourage exports.
Yeah.
A follow-up.
The China exchange rate is in question right now, I understand, whether or not they're going to raise the value of their... And that will have a big impact on Oregon, I'm sure.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, with the yuan being tied to the U.S. dollar and all the calls that are coming because of the large surplus trade balance that they're running with the U.S., and our expectations are is that they will probably appreciate the yuan, but only probably by a little bit, but still keep it tied to the dollar, because China's been saying all along that it wants to try to slow its fast-growing economy down just a little bit. And this would be a perfect way for them to do it, and also to gain some political positives out in the world by doing a little bit of an appreciation. But I don't think they'd go to a free-floating exchange rate yet.
Thank you.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, given that, and I recall vividly, as we all do, 02, and a number of your economic forecasts that missed the mark, frankly. And if variables have never changed, how can we have confidence that what you're doing now is going to give us an accurate picture if we've not changed the variables?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, this first was a response to what we were seeing happening in 2001-2002. So we wanted some more tools to help us in forecasting. And so this was devised in the summer of 2003 in order to assist us in that aspect. And as we go along today, you'll see that on our revenue model side, we've made dramatic changes in terms of the variables, how we look at it, in response to really what was a very terrible situation of having the revenues drop so dramatically. So we've, I believe, addressed that situation, have changed our variables, changed the way we look at our modeling.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Schrader.
Just to emphasize that, I think Representative Krupp brings up a real good point that this office has been very sensitive to, and new members should understand. Because we are a very income tax dependent state, it's very difficult for this office when there's dramatic swings in our economy to do the predictions. This is a model based on certain regular things happening, and when you have a dramatic recession or tremendous inflation, it can throw things off. If you look at Washington State's modeling during the early part of the recession, they were pretty much right on. They had the sales tax. Theirs doesn't change very much. It's much easier for the Office of Economic Analysis in Washington to model that, because there's just not those big swings. I'm not advocating we go one way or the other on this, but in response to the fact that our office felt the same concern, I think, that Representative Krupp has evinced, that a lot of us have been feeling, it was really neat to see them go in and try and figure out what are some
better indicators would more reflect Oregon's economy, given the fact we're an income tax dependent state. So they started working on this, and it's pretty interesting, I think, as we all have seen since 2003. Part of it's hopefully the economy, but part of it hopefully is this model. We're getting better projections. The projections are much closer, much more accurate than they were, you know, 3, 4, or 5 years ago. Quite frankly, going back a long time, as there would be big swings way under the forecast. So it'll be real interesting in this next biennium and the couple biennium after that to see if this really does do the job that we're hoping it does. So far, it's looking, I think, from my perspective as a member of Ways and Means, much better indicator than we've had before.
All right. Let's proceed.
This is the dark line is the Oregon Index of Leading Economic Indicators. The light line is a percentage change, 6 month annualized for employment. As you take a look across there, you can see that the index does lead the drops here in employment, and it does lead the rise that are coming up. We don't completely depend on this, but we also use this as a complement tool in our other type of modeling. Notice that if this indicator is working a little better, you can see that it's come down here in recent times, and this goes out, the most recent information we have is through November of 2004. Likewise, we've seen the growth of employment also coming down. Now, as I'll be talking a little bit more, we don't think this is any indication of return to recession. But it's very similar to what we saw in the U.S. economy was kind of a soft patch. And Oregon kind of had its own soft patch that this indicator was predicting. Here in this employment graph, this graph is showing that we lost about 65,400 jobs across the recession. In July of 2003, we started to add jobs, and we were adding quite nicely, and then we hit our own sort of soft patch in this period right here. A lot of it was due to, I think, uncertainties in the economy, uncertainties about the presidential election. We also had high energy prices, which can cause things to slow down. And then our high-tech sector was being met with reduced sales forecasts, building inventories. And so we had our own sort of soft patch in Oregon, similar to the U.S. economy. The December number has come up nicely with about a 1,700 increase in employment. And we think with other factors, the high-tech does not look as dire as it did just, say, 2 or 3 months ago. The energy situation is looking a little bit better, although the snowpack is not all that great, but other signs of even on the natural gas sign, things look like they're improving a bit. So we think that we'll be able to move through this soft patch and be back onto a little bit stronger recovery.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Co-Chair Doyle. let me begin by saying not a million years could I do your job. I do appreciate the work that you do. Can you send to my office two different charts? One, can you tell me the types of jobs that were lost versus the types of jobs that have been created, particularly in terms of wages? Second, and this goes back to my initial compliment, can you send me over a period of, say, 5 years what you and your staff have estimated versus what actually occurred? Thank you.
Okay, Representative, wasn't it?
Mr. Co-Chair, could that be provided to the members of the Ways and Means Committee?
Yeah, we'll work with Mr. Kowalski through the LFO staff to get this information.
Good questions.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that won't be any problem. We can do that. We do a tracking of our forecast to see how well it's doing over time. And also the type of jobs lost and jobs created, we can work with the Employment Department on that. In fact, they do have a study out that sort of addresses that question.
Thank
and
you.
That'll be a quick thing we can zip off to you, into the members.
Thank you.
Our outlook, as you can see, is after going through three consecutive years of job losses, we're looking at a job increase. 2004 should, when all is said and done and the data is all in, come in at about a 1.8% increase. 2001 is 2005 is going to be about a 2.1% increase, and it's relatively, in a sense, mild compared to what we saw back in the 1990s. Part of the reasons for this is, you know, during this recession, you always sort of look at what has really been in deficient demand over the recession, where people have really retrenched, and the retrenchment has really been mostly in the manufacturing sector. If we take a look at consumer spending, there wasn't much retrenchment there. The housing market, amazingly robust throughout the recession. The place where there's been mostly deficit has been in capital equipment spending. And Oregon is relatively a manufacturing-based economy relative to other states, and with this type of recession, it really hit us pretty hard. And that part is finally starting to come back up. So if that's the only part of sort of a deficit in terms of demand for spending to occur, we believe that the recovery is going to be relatively mild compared to past recovery periods.
How about the, How about the reductions, you know, looking in 06, 07, 08 in employment? That would be a concern, I assume.
Mr. Chair, no, I wouldn't really call this a concern, rather than
as rapid.
It's still positive growth, above, definitely above 1%. It's a coming back to what we would believe be more long-run historical trends for the state in terms of employment. Now, also, I will admit to you, once we get out to 2011, you notice we don't have any business cycle change in here either, either some huge boom or some big recession either. And our best guess is what's sort of the middle of the road that we might expect through this period of time if we would not have some sort of calamity or huge boom that would occur.
I guess as co-chair today, it's my honor to address for the first time Senator Betsy Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. I've just been sitting here sort of ruminating on a comment that you made about the snowpack and thinking it's 50 degrees outside, it's the middle of January. No snow in the mountains. Looking at my colleague from over in Eastern Oregon and thinking how dependent they are on water issues. And how seriously are you treating that issue in terms of its ramification to shippers and fish and all of the issues that pertain to energy and water?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we are concerned about that. In our modeling, we know that if we have a drought year, that affects, just as you had mentioned, especially our hydroelectric power. If we have to maintain flushing for fish, then that's going to be less water available for running the hydroelectric generators. Also, we know that almost all of our new generation capacity for electricity is natural gas-powered turbines. And we all saw what's happened to our heating bills this year. Those factors are, in essence, a part of what we have in here. To the extent that it's definitely a risk to this forecast, that it could be a worse impact than what we're looking at. But what having some countering to this is that, for example, the natural gas prices look like they're settling down a little bit. They're not continually increasing. And so hopefully that will be a positive mitigating factor. But throughout the state, and we're talking regionally, yes, you have some very serious problems, especially in the natural resource-based economies of our state.
Thank you.
Senator Whitson.
The capital equipment tax credit expired in 2004, federal tax credit, and many businesses invested quite heavily in during the last year or 2 years to take advantage of that tax credit. How would that have affected the apparent recovery of capital expenditure in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, definitely has had an impact here. And there, we believe that there's been some bunching up of investments because of that depreciation provision in the tax laws that, of course, as you mentioned, expired on December 31st, 2004. So coming forward, we think there's going to be a little bit softer capital spending because there's been this bunching up. So we think that the first quarter of this year is going to be relatively mild in terms of spending, but with the recovering economy, we should start to see that spending pick up. But not the kind of speed that we saw through 2004. Our personal income outlook, once again, it's sort of that same theme. We really got hit down below in the, if I can get my cursor here, in 2001, 2002, and 2004 has come back up. We still have one quarter of data not in, but with three quarters of data, we feel pretty confident that it'll turn out to be about this 5% rise. And then we have very, very mild, in a sense, rises relative to past historical times. And this is in line with our outlook that the recovery is also mild. There's always risks to every forecast. We think this is the most likely outcome, but there are things that could happen to push this forecast in one direction or the other. I've listed here some positives and some negatives. If you'd like me to, I can go through those. But in order to save time, if you want to get on to the revenue.
Yeah, let's proceed.
Okay. This is just a review of the items that I've just talked about. And we expect the manufacturing sector not to be as strong in terms of job growth as the non-manufacturing sector. And that seems to be playing itself out. And then with that, I'd like to introduce Michael Kennedy, our senior economist, to discuss the revenue forecast that this economic outlook feeds into.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. For the record, Michael Kennedy with the Office of Economic Analysis. What I'd like to do today, in addition to what we normally present, which is the latest forecast, I'd like to give a little more background on how we produce, in particular, the two income tax forecasts, as well as some additional information on how we produce the lottery forecast, both of which we have made significant modifications, as Senator Schrader mentioned, in the past 2 years. So first off, just to give a review of what actually constitutes the general fund. As Senator Schrader mentioned, we're highly dependent on income tax, more so dependent on the one source, personal income tax, than any other state is dependent on any one source for their general fund. You're looking about 86.4% for the current biennium projected, and that's much higher. I think Washington is about second, and they're roughly 65% dependent on their sales tax. So that just gives you an idea how unique we are among the states in the U.S. In addition, corporate income tax as well, a very volatile source, and it contributes an additional anywhere between 4% and 6% historically. Various other sources are roughly around the 1% range. You're looking at insurance and inheritance tax, cigarette and tobacco, and liquor. We've now had to divide out. You have various other routine sources, fines and forfeits from many different agencies, a variety of other sources that add up to roughly about 2%. And what we've done here now is started to divide out those routine sources from one-time actions, because in the last few years, those have become very significant, particularly in the last biennium. And what happens is when you lump them all together, before you had this huge drop and people were saying, what's happened to this source? And so it's easier now for people to identify, oh, it's dropped a lot, only because there were $450 million, say, in appropriation bonds last biennium. So all told, our current projection for the current biennium is about $10.2 billion. And we'd like to talk a little bit about guiding principles, because there can be various perspectives that different forecasting agencies across the U.S. can take. What we focus on here and try to do is give an unbiased, most likely to occur forecast. And the reason we do this is because, in principle, that will minimize the amount of variation over the course of a long period of time between actual revenues and what we forecast. And as always, we continue to refine these models. We look for new data sources. New data, actually, in the last 3 years is a significant reason why we've been able to make some of the improvements we've had, to which we thank, in particular, the Department of Revenue. And we employ any expert input we can find, for example, these revenue forecast advisors that we have recently started meeting with. And also, in addition, given the recent experience, we have started to provide now also a range around that forecast that you can likely expect revenues to possibly deviate. So it gives you that sense of the risk you're looking at when you budget any given particular number. The types of methods we employ, the OAA is directly responsible for forecasting personal and corporate income tax and the cigarette and tobacco tax. other significant sources are modeled and forecasted by the administering agency, who obviously has more insight and knowledge about that particular source. So in particular, OLCC provides us with a quarterly forecast for liquor apportionment. And in addition, other agencies provide us the other sources you see here. For smaller sources or ones that tend to be very stable over time, we use simple methods, average or historical trend. So with personal income tax being the most significant source, I'd like to give a brief overview on exactly how we go about producing this forecast. For both income tax forecasts, this is like the general conceptualization of the system we're looking at. So you have general economic conditions both in the U.S. and in Oregon, and that impacts the incomes that are earned by taxpayers, both personal and corporate. Based on an income and given tax law, you're looking at given tax liability for a given year. And then, obviously, we're forecasting when the dollars come in the door, so there's some relationship there between the liability and when we actually see the dollars. And you'll see this more in detail as we progress through here. The personal income tax model that we now employ is based upon income tax data from 1980 to 2002, both the income and the tax liability that shows up on those tax returns. We have now divided income into eight components, which are more directly related to certain economic variables from our model and from our national forecasting agency, Global Insights. So, for example, we now base our forecast for the wage and salary component that will show up on tax returns as a function of then the wage component of our personal income series that comes from our economic model. So that's an example of one of these relationships. And then based on historical, the effective tax rate, which is just the liability divided by income, so the percentage that people have paid in taxes relative to their income, we forecast that, and the two, income and tax rate, then give us a tax liability for any given year in the future. To give an idea of more explicitly what we're talking about, these are the 2002 data from full year Oregon resident tax returns. And the fact that this is 2002, this is the latest year we have, gives you an indication of one of the obstacles we face, and that's the data lag between what data we have and when we're forecasting. So right now, 2002 is the latest tax return data we have. We will get 2003 within the next month. So we're still actually forecasting 2003, 2004, even though they're long past. So that adds some of the variance we face in our forecast. But as you can see, in general, wages and salaries constitute the most significant portion of income earned by Oregonians at roughly 70%. And it's a fairly stable source, and it's good that it's so large because withholding tends to give us a really good indication of what's going on with incomes, wages, and salaries. So we're able to be a little more on top of this component in particular, given that indicator.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michael, forgive me. I could you reiterate why there's this lag time in terms of getting the 2003 data? And any suggestions, or is it possible to speed that up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, the lag is due to the fact that the tax returns themselves are not submitted until, say, as early as the February following the tax year, but as late as October 15th for extended returns. So that if you have, for instance, let's take 2003 as an example, those returns were done being submitted, at least except for amended returns, which will go on for a number of years, last October 15th. It then takes a couple months for those to be processed, to be error checked, and for the data to be compiled and submitted to us. There's a couple month lag. Department of Revenue puts in significant work to make sure that those data are accurate, recognizing that it's very important for us in terms of what we do here. In terms of what we do to overcome that lag and those issues, we do a number of things. I do look at current collections by tax year, and that gives me an indication, for instance, what that liability for, say, 2003 will likely be when all is said and done and we get the data. And that's something new we've done recently to really dig into those data and try to get an idea of what's going on real time before we actually then get this final data. We've done a number of examples of that. One is, like I just mentioned, using current withholding to give us an indication of what's going on in that series, even though it will be then a year before we actually know what happened on the tax returns.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Mike.
So that's wages. A number of these other series are fairly important, but not very volatile. The most important one here, obviously, in the last 5 years has been capital gains. As you can see here in 2002, it constituted roughly 4% of gross income reported on tax returns. That's down from 8% in 2000. So it is the most volatile here. And it poses a significant problem because they're, unlike the withholding and the wage component, there's little in terms of real-time indicators for what capital gains are being realized by taxpayers. You recognize that we have stock market indices, but there's so much that's behavioral about the realization of those gains or not that drives this, that that's still really loose relationship between what you're seeing in the economy in any given year and what you end up seeing on tax returns in terms of capital gains income.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are the numbers 2, 3, 4 referred to on the...
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, there, I actually excluded the footnotes here so that this could be big enough that anybody could read it, and I will explain what they are. Retirement, it just says that that includes IRA, IRA and pension and taxable Social Security. Schedule E, rents, royalties, S-Corp income, just describes what forms of income are reported on Schedule E, and other, the variety of sources, and the fact that most of other 90% of it is just unknown income. The Oregon tax return itself does not have the specific components. Those have to be grabbed from the federal return in a matching of those two things. For a certain amount of returns, that match is just not made. So the Department of Revenue doesn't know what those sources are. That ends up in that other.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Co-Chair Doyle. Can you expand on your definitions of proprietors and Schedule E again and the relationship those two have to the overall total?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, proprietors, if I'm not mistaken, the schedule is C, and those are proprietorships and partnerships, so non-S-Corp small businesses. And we relate that to a number of indicators, economic, particularly business indicators. Schedule E, we think, we actually don't have the subcomponents. There's something that I think the IRS possibly have, but that we're not able to retrieve. So what we do know is this is the total income that's taken from Schedule E and put on the tax return. But we do know that it's predominantly S-Corp income, so pass-through income from those entities.
Follow up.
Where would a limited liability company report, under a proprietor or Schedule E?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I'm fairly sure that it's on the Schedule E that a limited liability corporation would also report there.
One last.
Sure.
Where would a corporation in their income report?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, a corporation, a C-Corp, actually incorporated, would pay corporate income tax, so it wouldn't be anywhere in here.
It's not in the, in this. Okay. So this is
personal.
Personal income.
Right. These are 1040, or actually it's the Schedule 40 at the Oregon level, Schedule 1040, for the, where we get the income components.
Thank you. Thank you.
So in 2002, given all that, Oregonians, full year Oregonians, reported a total of $63.3 billion, and their tax due or tax owed was roughly $3.7 billion. So in that year, the effective tax rate, as we consider it, was 5.9%. Now, historically, during the 90s, that effective tax rate soared significantly, particularly as a lot of the non-wage and the capital gains income, which are earned by high-income Oregonians, really brought that effective tax rate up during that period. As you can see, there was a definite correction in 2001, 2002, back to what is considered the long-run average normal effective rate. And as you can see, we have it forecasted as growing at, you know, basically consistent with our overall economic forecast as being mild but definite growth. And the increase there is entirely due to bracket creep. As incomes move up the brackets, they are indexed for inflation, but as income moves faster than that index, still you have people moving up into higher and higher average tax brackets. Now, so then the only question is, we have an estimation or a projection of what we think will be the tax owed by Oregonians in any given year, and the question then is, when will we see those dollars? Now, for a normal year, we'll roughly see 80% of total liability arrive in the form of withholding taxes. Another 20% arrive as quarterly estimated payments. And roughly what is paid in, what I call prospective payments, will be equal to the liability that's ultimately owed. That is, the taxpayers on average are roughly correct, even though barely any of them are correct in as individuals. So what you'll see is then over the coming year, as people file their tax returns and make their payments, that those two will roughly offset each other. Now, I say in a normal year, when income grows faster than average, people tend to fall behind. In particular, safe harbor will bring people behind in their non-wage estimated payments, but even the withholding tables themselves, because they don't get revised every year, people will fall behind in that sense. So what you will see in particular, like 1995 through 1997, you'll see the final payments paid in the year after outweigh refunds, and you'll have net positive surprises. Conversely, if you look at 2001 and subsequently in spring of 2002, people got way ahead in terms of relative to what they owed as their incomes fell. Particularly when it falls, it's pretty much compounded by the fact that deductions, credits, subtractions tend to grow regardless of what's happening in the economy. So both what they're subtracting from their gross income is growing, but their incomes are falling. You get a very large drop in what their true liability is. But they tend not to recognize it real time. So what happens is then, particularly in spring 2002, we saw refunds outweigh final payments by $250 million. And we call that the unanticipated revenue surprise of 2002. The fact is, now that we've experienced that, the silver lining, for us at least, in terms of going through all that torture, was that we recognized that dynamic now. The fact is now, a year or more in advance, we should recognize, say I'll give an example for 2005, say, coming into the close of session forecast, we have 4 months of data, and we see that income isn't growing as fast as normal, or it's growing faster than normal. We would now be able to build into our projections this particular aspect. We would be much farther ahead. That surprise would now be in the close of session forecast rather than being a surprise to it.
Question?
Senator Frager.
Going back to your previous graph on the effective tax rate, are there any inferences we need to draw from that, in that, you know, we're now back to the effective tax rate of 1993 or so, as I would read that? So to get to the level of income for supporting state programs is going to take us another 6-8 years or something like that? Is that an inference we should draw from that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, I think it's very indicative of what happened. The fact that we were very flush, you can see this was an obvious factor in that. That we have returned to these normal levels, well, and actually fairly subdued levels, 01 and 02, you can see we do have growth coming out of this. Those are subdued because incomes, in fact, were subdued. I don't know what policy implications you would read from that. I mean, that's more, there's a lot of philosophy that goes into that in terms of how robust or not robust it is.
Well, I guess the reason I raised the point, Mr. Chair, is I think this is something we need to talk to our caucuses about, is different expectations. At least my read on this would be that, you know, we want to go back to the excellent programs we've had in the last, for some of us anyway, in the last few years. My read looking at that graph is, man, we are not going to get back there for 6-8 years, and we better plan accordingly down here in ways and means to make sure we communicate things effectively with our members upstairs. Might be a bigger chore for some of us than others, but just a concern. Thank you.
Good comment. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Sometimes I guess ignorance is bliss, and right now I'm pretty happy. So, Mr. Co-Chairs, I wonder if it'd be possible at the end of this, if it would be appropriate to schedule maybe a one-hour meeting with these folks to where they could help some of us who need more information and bring this down a little bit of a level. Because I'm still having trouble connecting all the dots, and I don't know if there's other people in here who could benefit from this, but I sure could use a little more help on this subject.
Mm-hmm. We'll see what we can do.
Okay. So let me move on to the corporate income tax model. As we've seen for this biennium, in fact, it's 6% of the general fund, so we devote equally a considerable time and effort to refining and monitoring this model. It's very similar to the personal income tax model. It's based on corporate tax liability from 1985 to 2001. You notice the year there is even farther behind. The corporate tax year isn't uniform. It can start anywhere up until December 1st of that tax year, so it can actually be in the middle of 2002 that you actually have half of your firm still in their 2001 tax year, so it makes it a little more interesting than the personal income tax model. And what we do is we basically base our liability projection as a function of U.S. corporate profits, which we get from our forecasting agency, Global Insights, and we apportion that based upon the ratio of Oregon personal income to national personal income. So that gives you just a rough apportionment factor. And the reason why this is valid is that roughly 83% for 2002 tax year of the taxpayers or the liability was associated with multi-state taxpayers that were basically taking their U.S. federal income and apportioning it down to Oregon based upon currently now sales, payroll, and property. So that's why this is a valid methodology for...
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Further define multi-state taxpayers. Give me an example. Are you talking about multi-state corporations?
Is that more, do we have more multi-state corporations doing business in here than we do Oregon-based corporations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, in number, there are far more small Oregon businesses. This is in terms of the proportion of liability. And in fact, corporate income tax liability is incredibly skewed. Basically, 1.4% of the taxpayers themselves account for, I think it's 75% of all the liability. So you have a few of the large companies that are the multi-states. I won't name names to avoid any confidentiality problems, but that really drive the entire corporate income tax liability number.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Which is one of the reasons why it's highly volatile, because you have just a few taxpayers.
Senator Morissette and Representative Hanson.
I don't remember what we did for the minimum corporate tax. That was $10, and I don't remember if we changed that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, it was in the House Bill 2152 tax package, revised significantly, increased and modified, and all of those facets of that tax package were repealed in the Measure 30 vote. So it's back to what it originally was in general.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the state of Oregon have an ability to be able to check either with federal, with these multi-state taxpayers, to be able to ascertain how much of their activity is occurring, how they're appropriating that activity to Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, we are able to, with a significant lag, as I've described, because corporate returns are even slower to get in. But I am fairly sure the Department of Revenue's research section is able to get those variables from the relative tax returns, so to know how they've apportioned based upon their relative property in Oregon versus property nationwide, et cetera, payroll and sales, which is how they apportion currently that federal income down to Oregon. So they're able to characterize it, I would say, and summarize it. Obviously, they can't, for any one company, they can't reveal any of those statistics, but they can give an idea of how that works. And in fact, legislative revenue has worked significantly with those variables to estimate what the impact of going to super sales, and now in 2008 will be 100% sales. Sales will be the only factor that is used to apportion federal income down to Oregon. So they have worked significantly with those variables to get a handle on that issue.
Thank you.
This graph just gives an idea of the relationship. What we have here is, in any given year, the tax liability for corporations, and the orange dashed line then is our computed Oregon profits, which is that national profits number apportioned down to Oregon based on relative personal income. And as you can see, here, I mean, there was a definite increase, a jump up during the 90s in that corporate profits number, but Oregon benefited disproportionately because of our high concentration of durable goods and high-tech manufacturing. And as we benefited disproportionately, we also suffered disproportionately. As you go forward, as Tom talked about the business investment cycle, obviously it was a significant bunching up prior to 2000 as firms were investing a lot in Y2K remediation, a lot of computer equipment. We saw that that really faltered during 2001, 2002, but it's since picked up, and that has contributed to what we've seen recently, which is a significant acceleration in corporate income tax payments.
Representative Kerr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a very instructive graph. Visuals are very powerful. And in this case, you make the case of the high-tech industry and what you've just stated in terms of prior to Y2K, and we have this very, very sharp increase. Is there a way that you can analyze this kind of empirical data that comes in is in terms of where to spot the trends, to see where we're going to go? When you have a huge increase of this type and you see that it is a very large portion of corporate profits and it skews these two figures so dramatically, can you extrapolate in the future when this might be occurring again with one particular industry that we may be overly dependent on, and can that be an accurate predictor, perhaps an accurate warning to us in the Legislative Assembly to be very careful not to depend on our budget decisions because we've got a lot of income coming in, maybe from one sector. So in other words, can you help us look through that crystal ball to the future?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, in fact, we've done a lot in the last years, and in fact, Department of Revenue is responsible for this, but they have started to provide us these data by sector, and so we have started to look at any given time what's going on. When you have relative changes, we're identifying, and in particular, they are coming from the manufacturing sector, no question. It's the most volatile and contributes to this. And in fact, you can see the product of this thinking in terms of these assumptions. I'll just look. We have, you know, the return, sort of the echo of this, you know, durable goods investment and it impacting Oregon's durable goods industries, and we've had a rebound in their corporate tax liability. As we've then said, we think that bonus depreciation law has again bunched up those investments, and that we are facing a situation where we could see, in particular in corporate profits, a drop, particularly in our Oregon manufacturing firms. It's already a function in our forecast. And that is directly based on what you're talking about, is taking a look at those things and getting a handle on exactly what was going on here and then saying, okay, what would our assumptions about the future then imply for future corporate tax?
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Co-Chair Doyle. Taking the information you've just given us and prior information, if you were setting the economic development policy for the state of Oregon and you were concerned about generating revenue for the state of Oregon, would you focus more on small business job creation or large industry job creation in terms of revenue generation for the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, it's a very interesting question.
You want to get up here and sit with us, Mike?
And I think it's a fair question to ask based on the fact you're giving us corporate information, and just a few minutes prior you're giving us information on small business.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, it really depends on what your aim is. If you're really looking on revenue for the state of Oregon, as I've described, you have very few taxpayers that are virtually entirely responsible, at least for the corporate income tax. On the other hand, it's only 5% or 6% of the general fund, so you don't want to just focus on that as one specific. You wouldn't want to say, I want to maximize corporate income tax to the exclusion of all else. It wouldn't get you a whole lot. So if you look at the broader set of general fund revenues, if personal income taxes is the greatest, then you're into the position where it's really not as clear whether focusing on large business versus small business gets you relatively better results.
I don't want to let you off the hook yet. I want to know, and if we have to do further analysis, I'll work with you. I'll spend every minute you need working on this. I want to know what is going to generate more revenue for the state of Oregon, focusing the state on creating small business jobs or focusing on large industry-focused industry sector jobs. Because right now in this building there's a real question as to which way the state ought to go. And I think you are a tool to help answer that question in terms of who's going to generate the most revenue for the state of Oregon and provide stability for the state's economy. And I think those folks who are truly interested in jobs ought to be pounding down your door trying to do that analysis, and then we ought to target our efforts towards the answer you give us.
Mr. Chair.
And I'm just thinking, Representative Smith, we might find a spot for you over in the Revenue Committee.
I don't understand any of this. I just know that's a fair question.
Yes. Representative Farrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then two other questions come to mind as Representative Smith is chatting with you here. The predictor model that you're now using in terms of revenue providing you information by sector, okay? How, if you could look back at that number there from 91 up to, you know, 98, 99, and that incredible growth, high tech primarily, how does that relate to you being able to predict what is the lag time between that graph in corporate profits and activity? What's the lag between that and the effect on personal income? Personal income taxes, in other words, people being laid off or hired, okay? And then secondly, employment, numbers of people that are employed. So in other words, we're talking about big employers. I mean, you just said, I think I made a note, 1.4% of corporate taxpayers account for 75% of our corporate tax liability. Was that an accurate statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, it's somewhere in that range, and I
somewhere,
think that
okay.
It might even be 90%. I just know it was a substantial
portion. So if that huge increase in that graph is from Intel, Tektronix, and Cisco, and people like that that were employing here in the 90s, and business was booming, then can you show us the lag time that there was between employment trends, hiring, personal income increasing, downturn in corporate profits, downturn in personal income, and how do you forecast that for the future? So in other words, in the future, you just showed us here where the business depreciation law had a spike in manufacturing, and now it's come back down again. How does that give us an idea of what we can expect to see in terms of personal income and employment?
And if I may, Representative, you might want to tailor that to maybe some of the discussion earlier about the Oregon leading economic indicators, because I think that was where he was driving, is looking at that kind of differential.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, there is a little bit of problem in making the inference between this period and the future, in particular because productivity increased so much during the recession, that really what you've seen, whereas back here there was a definite correlation between all those corporate profits, all that activity, and increases in employment. There were incredible employment gains as well during the 90s. What you've seen now in this particular run-up here in recent, the last year and a half, is that the employment really hasn't followed it. And the reason is because productivity jumped so much. There are definitely reports, even at Intel, where the floors now are empty, whereas you would have normally seen a number of people running around them. So, you know, all this automation has created somewhat of a disconnect relative to historical relationships. And so we haven't seen employment jumping up, even as the corporate profits are soaring. One of the reasons they're soaring is because labor costs are a lot lower now. And so, given that they didn't follow that run-up up, there's probably also less of a likelihood that even if those profits do fall in the durable goods sector, that you would see a corresponding decrease in employment, because they really didn't hire a bunch of people to begin with to have them then be laid off. So it's sort of a disconnect has come into play currently relative to historical relationships.
And Mr. Chair, what about the lag time then? Again, when you see corporate profits accelerating and then you see them level off and come back down, you can probably extrapolate that in so many months we're going to have a lessening of the amount of personal income tax coming into the state based on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, historically, yes, there would have been that relationship. Personal income, because it's mostly wages and salaries, would be along the same lines as this employment, such that there would now be sort of a disconnect between what's going on relative to what you would see historical. You're definitely correct. There is a lag It takes companies a while to recognize what's going on, and they are reluctant, you know, to fire on just, say, a few months of data. So there is, you know, a 6 month to a year lag before you start to see them addressing what's going on, say, in their bottom line.
Right. And then also, Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, different conditions can cause profits and thus our corporate tax revenues to change relative to what's going on in the economy. For example, now we might see firms that are somewhat reluctant to hire. They really want to see that their business is going well, and so they're really pushing their skeletal labor force as much as possible. And then the profits might be quite high then, and then our taxes. As they start to reach capacity constraints and business is still good, they need more workers, you know, so they hire more. That'll help our personal income to start to go up. We might see corporate profits being squeezed a little bit because their costs have risen. So that's not an indication that things are bad. That will see personal income go down. It actually, you know, could still start to even go up further because of that action. Unlike a recession, where then they both, you know, move together.
Thank you, Representative Hanna.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Michael, I don't want to make this too wordy, but it kind of goes to Representative Smith's thinking of how this works. If we go back and say that. The corporate tax is somewhere shy of 7% of the total personal income tax, just looking at your graph. And then we said, what percent of the personal income tax is generated by employment within that 5% of the folks that are generating the corporate income tax? You follow me? I mean, how many people are employed by that 5% paying the corporate income tax? Because we know that that's generating personal income tax, but it goes to Representative Smith's question. Are we focusing on these big companies who get lots of press and, you know, employ 3,000 or 4,000 people in a place, or should we be out here working on the under 100 group that is a different economic picture? Can we peel apart that and find out what the employment level is by those 5% corporate taxpayers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, you can do some estimates of it. Obviously, we can't identify a particular taxpayer as being a major taxpayer because that right there violates the confidentiality law. So you really have to go at it maybe from the reverse end. You have to assume that a taxpayer you're looking at is one of your high paying taxpayers and then look at their employment relative to the total.
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Co-Chair Doyle. How come we couldn't pull an annual report of one of these corporations and find out what they're paying? That's public information upon request. And then do an analysis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I'm actually not an expert on that particular issue. I do know that the Department of Revenue cannot reveal anything associated with a taxpayer and how much they pay.
You can follow up.
For sure.
You come visit me and I'll show you how to pull that information right off the web. Do it all the time.
Representative Smith, I think I don't know if we can find exactly and be able to say for that firm what comes to Oregon. Generally, this firm, especially the multi-state ones, will have a national one on their annual report and not apportion it down. We know there, and I'm sure we could do it off the Oregon forms, but revenue is not allowed to show us that information because of the problems.
Right.
And also going back to the other point, you know, I don't know if it's so much that it's a black or white to say, do you support small businesses or do you go after large corporations? I think you in some sense, for us, we need some economic development that goes after helping up-and-coming firms. At one time, Nike was a small business.
Just one last comment. I promise to stay quiet. Thank you, Kutcher. I'm not looking to make a decision. I just want to look at the number and decide who brings in the greatest amount of revenue to the state of Oregon. That's all I'm looking for. And then it's up to my co-chairs to decide how my subcommittee will work in that area, but I would just like to know that for myself, who generates revenue and what's that mean to the state, and then I defer to my co-chairs.
Well, and just as a note, too, although I gave you a bad time earlier, Representative, it was your subcommittee's responsibility is economic development.
That's right.
And how we fund, you know, any state programs towards economic development. You know, it's useful information to have. Senator Morissette?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The idea of job spinoff is an interesting idea because some multinational or large corporations generate more, a greater amount of job spinoff, so that's part of the equation. Secondly, I think small business in rural Oregon depends upon, for instance, if you bring one doctor into a community, that would generate, I believe, 17 jobs. The healthcare industry, the education industry provide jobs and spinoff for other kinds of business. So I think we have to look at that spinoff. Now, I don't know if you have a way of desegregating or looking at the spinoff factor of a particular type of business. The Monaco Coach Company generates more, a greater amount of spinoff for subcontractors. Intel, they use subcontractors, they may. So the job spinoff, I think, is an important question as well.
Okay. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Butcher, just a quick comment. It's really not going to be as simple as saying where are we getting the most bang for the buck, because with large corporations, you have outsourcing. We have new plants being developed in China and India and Russia that weren't there 10 years ago that will affect what happens with large corporations that may have been tremendous employers in the past. And then, as Senator Morissette says, the concerns in rural areas are much different than those in urban areas, and the inability to cluster where you have to have support for different jobs. Joseph, Oregon has boundaries, and they have support for that, and that's wonderful. To try and do that in Burns is going to be pretty tough unless you have the support for whatever industry it is that you want to establish. You certainly can't just put a factory in a community and assume that it's going to flourish, because there's so much that goes into it as far as resources, marketing, support staff, technological backup, and all those various factors. So it seems to me it's a lot more complex than merely looking at where the numbers are and then just going there.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Morissette and Representative Richardson, some of our modeling tries to get at those points. For example, if we see that there's going to be increase in, say, a manufacturing job area, our modeling then has tie-ins to say, well, that's going to affect things like some personal income. If personal income is higher, there's spillover effects. Maybe retail will go up because of this, because these people are going to be spending their wages and buying things. So there are these feedback effects that we try to get these sort of multiplier effects to occur and try to pick those up.
And Mr. Kennedy, on knowing the next slide is actually something that, as the Ways and Means Committee, we actually need to really move to. beyond, you know, some of the theory here or the principles of how you develop the forecast, we're going to be getting to that point. And I'm wondering if 10 minutes is enough for you to finish things up, or are you going to need more time than that?
Mr. Chair, I can get it done.
As long as we behave ourselves, right? And appreciate that.
You're asking a lot, Mr. Chair.
I don't know. Thank you.
Well, and in fact, because really this is kind of old news, it's been out there for a couple months, I can go fairly quickly through this. This is our current forecast for the 2003-2005 biennium. As you all know, we have total resources now projected at $10.3 billion. That's just slightly down for a couple of issues I elaborated on in our release. So the bottom line here is that right now we're projecting an ending balance of $90.6 million, which is really the key that you want to look at for this biennium. Just, we are currently on track to be within budget. In terms of the kicker, slight reduction in corporate income tax projected for this biennium reduces the kicker for next biennium. It's now $40.3 million. We've looked historically at how each forecast during a biennium performs, and that allows us then to give you an idea of the relative potential for actual revenues to deviate from each forecast. So when you look at December forecast at this point in the biennium, on average, the error is roughly 2%. So that allows us then to tell you, for instance, it's highly probable that actual revenues will fall within a 200 plus or minus range of the current forecast if historical variances are an indicator for the future, which we believe they are. However, there are a few instances historically where the error has been more than that, even with only 6 months left in the biennium, notably 81, 83, 95, 97, and 2001, 2003. So the potential is there, at least theoretically speaking. From what we're seeing right now, though, I will say, and in particular, I now have even 2 months more of data, which still looks like we're very much on track, and this particular forecast will be very close to what we eventually see. Next, I'm going out of order here. I'm going to jump really quick to risk for this biennium, because the only things that would really throw this off in the coming 5 months are that the business investment slowdown that we currently have modeled in here just happened to come faster and be more severe. We're still, obviously, as Tom mentioned, we're not seeing that, particularly in announcements by Intel. The other is the sort of April surprise that you have tax season coming up, and that you can vary from the normal that payments and refunds roughly cancel each other out. But as we've said, we have a pretty good handle on that, and there's nothing about what we've seen for 04 that would lead us to believe that such an occurrence would happen. So, I mean, we're fairly confident right now that we're tracking very well. Now, let me jump back to the next biennium, which you will be more interested in dealing with. We're currently projecting, at least for general fund alone, 11.1, slightly short of $11.1 billion in revenues. And then with that 90.6 ending balance, if that were to hold up, you'd be looking at a total general fund resources of 11.159. And that was a slight revision downward for the issues I elaborated on in earlier releases. So now, in terms of what risks are out there for the longer term, in general, here it would just be departures from what we currently, the assumptions underlying our economic forecast. So those assumptions about what's going to happen in employment, what's going to happen in personal income. It's any departure then from that economic scenario, what oil prices are going to do, what's going to happen in the global economy, etc. And other than that, more specifically, still that capital gains component's in there and has the potential to cause problems. Right now, we really believe that we're sort of at the low end of what the risks are for that. I think it's more of an upside risk just because we really have incorporated a lot of potential loss carryforwards, really keeping those taxable gains down. I believe the risk would be more 60% upside and 40% downside, given our experience and our gun shyness about that particular component. So looking over the long term, this forecast really did not do much to change our long-term outlook about general funds. Slight reduction mostly due to a drop in expected personal income growth, a couple percentage points out into the future. In terms of growth rates, this chart gives an indication of what you're facing, the feeling you have about this fiscal situation. If you look historically, over the past two decades, general fund growth per biennium was in the roughly the 15 to 16% range. And so now you're looking at this biennium, when you correct for kicker refunds, you're looking at 4.9% alone. Next biennium, still only 9.2%. So, I mean, that's why there's the pervasive feeling that funds are limited. The fact is they're not growing as they have historically. Even out into the future, our long-term expectation, given our economic outlook, you're looking at only 12 to 13%. So still definitely more moderated than what we experienced during all the high-tech boom and durable goods manufacturing growth in the state. With that, I'd like to move on to lottery. And I'm adding here just a little bit of methodology. Video poker sales and the earnings resulting from that account for roughly 85% of the total, so we focus a lot of effort on trying to refine this model and improve its accuracy. We forecast for lottery sales on a weekly basis. And for video poker, the long-term change in video poker sales we model as a function of consumer spending. Video poker behaves a lot like any other, say, discretionary normal good, and historically it has tended to track consumer expenditure growth.
Yes, Senator Cordley.
Thank you. And good morning, Mr. Kennedy, Mr. Potowski. I'd like to get right to a question about the projection for new line games. And would you please tell this committee how much faith we should place in that projection for new line games? How comfortable are you with that projection? Talk to us about the assumptions leading to the projection. I will tell you, frankly, I am very nervous about resting a part of such a large portion of the budget on line games.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley. Let me first clear up a misperception that has actually been out there amongst all of us who have been working on this issue. Previously, I'll go back a year or 2 years. What we'd all been thinking we were talking about was what would be the impact of merely adding that part of the game, the line games, to the product. So just changing the nature of the product, what impact would that have? And Lottery did a lot of research into various jurisdictions, states, provinces, with line games or without, and we looked at the variance there. The fact is that the estimates they came up with are reasonable, and the only thing to be careful of there is there's just a wide variance across all those jurisdictions. That definitely the line game states or provinces, Canadian provinces, have much higher per capita sales. But if you look at any given state relative to any other state, Montana makes more than any of the line game states per capita, and they don't have line games. So it's not that the estimate is not reasonable. It's a perfectly reasonable point estimate, and really it just needs to be recognized that there's a wide range of potential outcomes when you, in fact, do that. Let me go on to qualify then. That's only one aspect now of what's being targeted. The money that or the estimates they now have out there are really a target. It's much like the 108 this biennium, that this is something they will do a number of different actions to try to get to, of which only the line games and the sales impact of that is just a part. So, and this is going to be talked about, obviously, probably in much more detail. We can go into it, but I just think it needs to be out there that the estimate itself or the target itself is well within what you see in the data.
And just to follow up with that is, as you were saying, how every week you change your forecast for lottery, is that working with, you can clarify that, but are you working with lottery on that number, or as you're looking at forecasts, is it lottery telling you this is what the projection is going to be, or how do you work with lottery, I guess, to come up with that revenue projection?
Mr. Chair, the revenue projections itself we do quarterly. We're forecasting how much will be sold each week, but we revise that forecast each quarter. We've produced the models and do the projection, but we do interact with lottery directly. Lottery is very different from our other revenue sources in that they actually have management actions they can take and do take on a regular basis that influence the sales themselves. So it's much different than personal income tax. Department of Revenue just sees it come in, but they don't really do much to change it. So there's a lot more here where we have to interact with lottery to know that they're releasing a new game, they're changing a product, they're taking the system down for a day, something like that. And we work very directly with them on a weekly basis.
Okay. Senator Devlin.
I had a follow-up.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator.
That's quite all right. That's quite all right. And so, again, for the record, we should not be nervous then about the projection, which you are describing as an estimate and a reasonable estimate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, when we provide our forecasts, we then are responsible for telling you what the potential range is around that forecast, and then that's information you will use basically to make your budgetary decisions. If I give you a wider range, that's something that just needs to be taken into account in terms of how comfortable you are taking the associated risk should, in event, the worst outcome actually happen. But you do this with personal income tax. You do this with anything else.
My concern, Mr. Chair, is that we are anticipating plugging a hole in the budget with revenues that do not currently exist. We are hopeful that they will exist and that the revenues will rise to a certain level. And again, yes, I am putting you on the spot. Just trying to narrow it down and really understand how we have arrived at this projection. We're talking millions of dollars here.
Do you have a response to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gourley, in fact, this isn't unusual in the sense that tax law changes are made all the time, and Legislative Revenue Office will go in and estimate, and it's a projection based upon an unknown outcome, so it's really nothing new in that sense.
Thank you. And I apologize again, Senator, for stepping over you.
No problem.
Senator Devlin?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This is just a clarification on that. My understanding is that the Lottery Commission can proceed with line games without additional statutory or constitutional authority. They already have the authority. You would be doing a forecast then that isn't really impacted by change in statute, so you don't not you always have to rely on current law, but current law apparently would allow them to do this, and you looked at the current practice or proposed practice. Does this mean that when we get a March forecast, this is my question, that you will do an honest, good faith estimate of what that revenue will be, and since that action by the Lottery Commission may not be able to be put in place for some time, and my more normal understanding with lottery revenue is it lags by about a quarter in terms of receipt of the revenue, that you will do an honest, good faith estimate in the March forecast of what that will do to add line games?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, it's an interesting situation right now given what you're talking about, in that it's in development. So we will do everything in our power to characterize the impact of this. We are working currently on a daily basis with budget management, legislative revenue, legislative fiscal, and lottery to determine exactly how we're going to factor these impacts, these changes they're going to make into the forecast. But as we have a better understanding of what they will be, what they will do, and what the impact will be, that will get factored into our forecast. I'll just give an example right now. The commission rate structure is one of the issues that's out there and being discussed. As you've probably seen that in the newspaper, there's a lot of uncertainty exactly how that's going to play out between the retailers. And so we are still working really hard to figure out exactly how we're going to characterize it in our forecast. When will we know exactly what we can estimate a dollar figure for?
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Follow up? Just a clarification on that. Just from my standpoint, I believe it would be the standpoint of many Ways and Means Committee members. I will rely on your forecast of what those lottery revenues are to determine what we can fund and what we cannot fund, not just some arbitrary figure that's put out in the budget process as the potential revenue. So whatever you say in that forecast is what we'll probably base the budget on.
Mm-hmm. Senator Gourley.
Thank you. Continuing the discussion in this vein, and this is to the co-chairs, I believe we're going to need some clarification that is legal, perhaps an opinion from legislative counsel that says definitively whether we can use the lottery line game revenue for the purpose of funding the Oregon State Police. I'm not aware that we have requested an opinion or seen anything, again, definitive in writing. I know this is the governor's desire, but could you please advise on how you see this piece being addressed?
Yeah, sure. If you don't mind, Co-Chair. I have made a request to legislative council for that opinion. Specifically, the Constitution provides the lottery can fund education, economic development, parks, fish and wildlife, I believe, and that's pretty much the limit. So how does state police fit into that? Now, the governor did fund in his budget the Fish and Wildlife Division of the state police. There might be a possibility there. But the patrol division, I think, is the question. So we expect that anytime.
I do want to just add, I want to be very clear that it is my strong desire to see that the Oregon State Police patrol function gets funded. That's something that we must do. And I'm just questioning our process leading to that hopeful result.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Richardson.
Mr. Co-Chair, this is also continuing with this concept on the lottery, and it's kind of a revenue issue, but my understanding is that the lottery presently is awarding about $8.3 billion in prizes a year before it's expanded, and I don't have any information on the taxation of that, whether or not that's closely watched, and also whether or not these forecasts include the additional taxes that will be generated on the additional prizes that will be generated by the additional line games which are about to be instituted. And so I'm just wondering if there's additional taxes that will be part of our revenue forecast, and is there a way that we can watch that more closely since we're talking about a lot of money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, in fact, you don't get much of a tax impact because there are more losses out there than there are prizes. That's how we make the money. So given that you can actually offset any winnings with any of your losses, your higher players have racked up enough losses that any one of their big winnings, they tend to pretty much whittle it down to nothing.
Really?
Yeah. There's a quick comment. Senator Devlin indicated that the legislature has no control over what the lottery does, or seemed to give that impression. I just would remind members that we have the ability to allocate or not allocate lottery revenue, and I would certainly hope that the Lottery Commission would take into account whether or not that it seems to be the sentiment of the state legislature to go to line games and allocate revenue from that particular source, and I'm sure they'll be looking forward to our deliberations over the next few months.
Senator Devlin.
Mr. Co-Chair that spoke, I agree with your statement, but I think the reality in terms of whether or not they could start down this path without further statutory authority is relatively clear that they can. And then I'm faced with also the reality that if you don't have that revenue, where's the revenue going to come from? Or are we going to have to cut the additional, presuming their estimates are anywhere close to reality, $120 million we'd lose without it?
Mr. Kennedy, I guess to the point about just the, I guess, the accuracy or the validity of your forecasts with, say, as we move to live games. One issue that was dealt with last biennium was the increase from 5 machines to 6, and I'm assuming you modified your projections with that additional machine. Is there any data to suggest that your forecasts were accurate or not accurate on, you know, seeing that shift in, in the decision by the commission to expand?
Mr. Chair, in fact, we did include what lottery had basically given us as an expected impact into the model. And in fact, as you know, the sales show, they've tracked the forecast fairly well and slightly above. And so, but it's very hard to piece out exactly where all that growth comes from.
Okay. Thank you. All right, let's proceed.
Just very quickly, traditional games, we do much the same way. We model gross weekly sales against a number of variables, trend and seasonal variables, and even weekly variables when paydays occur. And these models, for the most part, tend to fit very well and track forecasts very well. So to recap, for this biennium, the forecast still, the estimate for total revenue and resources and beginning balance is 784, so $784 million. The ending balance right now is projected in the Economic Development Fund at 65.6 million, recognizing that 67 million was additional limitation above and beyond appropriations was granted, so that money is still in fact spoken for and will be transferred to the state school fund. So really the ending balance is roughly zero at this point. The extended forecast, as I said, the change to go to a modeling video poker on consumption growth was a recent model change, and in fact in going to do that it raised our long-term expectations for growth from about 4% to 5%. So all of the change here is strictly related to increased anticipated growth in video sales. You were speaking about distributions, and this chart just shows where historically and where the projected revenues would go. As you can see, the white in particular changes are increased expectations for debt service, increased bonding against lottery proceeds. And I'll turn this back to Tom.
Just to wrap up, for information that you may want from our office and what we can provide to you, go to our website that provides the population forecast, our prison forecast, all the sort of things that our office is involved in, and any information that we can provide to you, we're here to help.
Great. Gentlemen, appreciate your comments, your insight, and certainly the questions from the panel. That were very good education about our state's revenue. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Just as a closing question, you may not know this, but has the lottery shared with you the cost of retooling to accommodate expanded video offerings?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we don't look at the details of their budgeting. It's really implicit in the transfer rate assumptions we use going forward. It's a factor in there, but we don't look any closer to that for our purposes.
That doesn't surprise me. I just thought maybe you'd know. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Dale Penn. Oh, Mr. Rocco. Oh, okay.
Just an IT tech.
Technical assistant.
And a darn good one at that.
You don't need to pair a gas assessment then.
That's right. Ask Dale Penn to come forward, our lottery director, for an overview of the lottery. And at least our members, Mr. Penn, are looking to... only this being a two-hour meeting, which means that you got about a half an hour, but I will offer some leeway on that based on the number of questions you get from the members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm director of the lottery, and I will try to go over very quickly just the material we brought, and we are passing out copies of these slides and perhaps address a couple of the questions that I've heard just in the last few minutes, because I imagine that's really what you want to talk to me about. First of all, I might just respond to the question of Representative Richardson concerning taxation of winnings. And at the present time, any prize over $600 must be brought to the lottery headquarters to be paid, and that is because there is going to be automatic withholding for that prize. The $600 limit has been something that's been discussed many times over the years. Payments are made of $600 and below by vendors, and the administrative task of trying to focus all winners at some lower rate to come to Salem to receive payment is very difficult, and so that limit was established at $600. But anything above that is automatically withheld.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Penn, what is the percentage of the total amount of prizes that exceed $600?
Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, I'll have to find that out for you. It is not a large number. Obviously, megabucks payouts and Keno jackpots and other things along those lines. But we put some limits, like in video. There is a limit of a $600 jackpot. on the video machine. So the it's a small percentage, but they tend to be big dollar payouts. If I can move just to our quick presentation, I'm going to go over this very quickly, some of the ideas that we wanted to present to you. They've just covered key topics, a mission statement, and our budget process. I'm going to go right to our mission statement, the next page, and that's our goal is to operate a lottery with the highest standards of integrity and security. That's a very important key point. We emphasize security and integrity in the lottery so that the public does trust that these games are fair and they are administered fairly, but to earn maximum profits for the people of Oregon commensurate with the public good. We have an organizational structure of five-member commission. Presently, we have four members. We have an opening for a member who is a CPA. We have one other mandatory requirement for a member, and that's to be a member of law enforcement or experience as a law enforcement officer. And then there are three other members without specific criteria. They are appointed by the governor and confirmed after review by the Senate. I also would be appointed by the governor and serve at the pleasure of the governor, confirmed by the Senate after their review. And we have a number of assistant directors here today just concerning security, marketing, retail operations, and support services. Quickly, our constitutional mandate was established in 1984. It established the Lottery Commission and the Lottery Fund to operate as a self-supporting revenue-raising agency of state government. There is a listing there of the different measures that over the years have dedicated different amounts of lottery funding to different subjects. This is a quick view of how the legislature and the Constitution has divided those dollars that are transferred to the state. One of the things that I learned as a lottery director that I didn't know, as just a member of the public, of how much bonding has been funded by the lottery, and so we're in the process now of selling bonds to do the dredging of the Columbia River. There is a huge amount that is able to be done in the state of Oregon because of that bonding capability, which is backed by the lottery. Games that we have developed over the years, you'll see that the commission has initiated a number of these games. The legislature has directed us to initiate several games. Down at the bottom of the commission-initiated games, you'll see line games with question marks. Next Wednesday, the Lottery Commission will hear testimony and make a decision on the issue of should the Lottery Commission authorize line games. I know that you're going to want to talk about that. You've already discussed it. But clearly, I need direction from the commission if, in fact, line games are going to be initiated for us to make any close deadline of July. We are already in the stages of doing preliminary work, but obviously that is a tight timeline for us.
Mr. Penn,
yes.
Set any odds yet on the likelihood of...
No, not yet, Mr. Chair.
And I didn't think you were a gambler.
I didn't think he was funny.
Point. It was a gamble to make that joke.
Yeah, all right, all right.
I've put a slide in, and I won't really discuss it. It just highlights for you some of the changes that have occurred over the years in introduction of new games, and we can see that sales have continued to increase as new games and different methods have been utilized. A quick overview of our budget process. We are a zero-based budgeting organization. We begin with zero and build from there. We review our past performance measures and plans. A strategic plan is developed by the commission. We then developed a business plan, a marketing plan, a financial plan. We put that back to departments to review and develop projects to implement those plans. Ultimately, those directions are submitted to the governor's office for review and reviewed by the lottery commission, and ultimately the lottery commission adopts our budget and gives us direction on those issues. Quickly on revenue and expense distribution, traditional games, you'll see the average prize payout on these games, and each individual game is a little bit different, but averages 64-65%. When it says transfers to the state, in 2004, that was right around $60 million. And you can see the operating expenses of the lottery and then game-specific expenses. You're talking about scratch-it tickets, having them printed, the production of the game, that type of situation. Video lottery, immediately you'll see, well, gee, there's a lot of prize payout here, 93%. And yet, the difference in these two games or categories of games, you'll see that the transfers to the state only 3.7%, and yet that's $292 million a year. In the last 2 years, it's been close to $300 million a year. Mm-hmm. And so you see this pie, even you look at the percentage, it's pretty small, but this pie is much, much larger, and the circumference is much larger. And so small percentages make a big difference.
Question, Representative Richards.
Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Pinn, can you tell us how we compare as a state with the amount, the percentage of revenue that comes to the state as compared to other states? And also, well, that one first.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, it's very difficult to compare us to other states. And the reason is that we are probably the only state that in utilizing video lottery, we do not have a casino. And I'm not expressing any opinion about whether or not Oregon should have a casino, but that changes the dynamics extensively. Other states also have large racetrack operations where they have, in effect, casinos at the racetracks, and that is their video lottery product. So it's very difficult to look at that. We can look at our own experience and see that it has been very productive, and when you look at transfers to the state of Oregon, and back at that earlier slide about sales, you could see where we were down with a traditional product, very small amounts, relatively speaking, below $100 million, and suddenly start spiking up to now, the transfer in this last biennium was $770 million in that biennium. So video product has made a huge difference and has been very successful and has continued to be on an upswing since we've operated it.
Follow up. The reason I bring it up, the 1% difference, say that state got 1% more, that's, you know, 80 some million dollars.
Yeah.
And so although it may be difficult, I think it'd be beneficial for us to have a feel for how it compares, because if, you know, we certainly want to be generous, but we want to be in line with other states, because it could make a tremendous amount of difference in the amount of revenue that we get. Follow-up question is on the percentage of fees that we pay to the proprietors. Can you tell us how Oregon compares with the percentage of fee that we pay, because that also would have tremendous amount of effect on revenue?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, you've got two hot questions there. The first one, though, I misunderstood when you first asked it, and I think you were talking about prize payout. And so how do we compare? And really the industry average right now for, let's say, line games is a 92% payout game. And so as we look at line games in Oregon, if in fact we do go to line games, we would be looking at instituting a 92% payout game. However, we right now are a poker establishment, I guess. Our video games are all poker games. And what happens is players, we advertise what the payouts are on them. They're on our website. And players know. And so there is little differences in particular games, and a number of years ago, actually when our sales spiked up, We saw that a particular poker dean has a little bit higher payout than others. And guess what dean is the one that most people play now? We're kind of stuck with it. When you try to change it, players recognize that, and we lose sales. We actually try to modify the poker game set about 6 years ago, and we saw a flattening of our revenues. And so that prize payout is very important on the popularity of the game, and that is a balance, that you need to have the prize payout to be sufficient that players are interested and want to play, and your sales go up, and yet do it to a point that you maximize the revenue. And that's the challenge, and we're constantly looking at that, and we do try to benchmark with other jurisdictions, and that's why I say as we look at line games, that's exactly how we're going to start out with that game.
Final comment?
Yes.
Since the overarching goal is to maximize revenue, not to maximize sales, I would hope that we would be looking at that, because the goal is not merely to collect more gross money from people's personal mm-hmm. budgets, but to generate more money for, you know, for the state coffers.
Yeah.
And so if there is flexibility there that would generate more revenue for the state, mm-hmm. certainly we're interested in that.
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, absolutely, that is our overarching goal, as we say in the slide, that's certainly important. You asked me a second question that is complicated, and that is retailer compensation. And obviously that's been in the news a lot, and I've kept trying to focus back on the concept that, first of all, there has to be authorization of line games. But a lot of the news focus has been, well, if you do line games, then what is the compensation level? If you compare, and the complicated situation is we don't have an exact comparison. We can't go to a state or a place and say, this is the Oregon experience. If you compare other states, our commission rates are very low. However, we are a little different than other states in that we operate the games. We buy the materials, we produce them, we put them out into the public, whereas in other states in the United States, they are purchased and owned by the business owners. And so that's a big difference. You look at Canada, and they have a network that they operate themselves. In some degree, though, Canada is a foreign country with different tax laws, different culture, and all of that taxation issue. That makes it difficult to say, well, we can target that Canadian province and say that's the same as Oregon. However, it does give us some guidelines. And their provinces go from a blended rate of 15% to 24.5%. The controversy that comes forward is when line games, if they are approved, then there will have to be an adjustment of commission rates. And that would be an issue that would be debated in February and March if the commission authorized line games on Wednesday, because they'd have to adopt a rule. And we'd have a two-month rulemaking process. All of those issues will come forward, and the ability of the state to capture the additional revenue from sales is a very important part of that debate, and one that I believe is paramount. So that's something, I guess, to watch in the next few months. I simply...
One more question, yeah. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Co-Chair Doyle. I recognize now how you folks are managing this question purely for my own edification. I want to follow up on Representative Richardson's question. Would you be willing to provide us with prize elasticity information on your prize payouts? I'd like to know what a tenth of a percent change in prize payout would generate in terms of revenue, both up and down. And the reason I ask this question is when I look at the retailer compensation of 1.97%, and then I look at the prize payout, to me it seems like a tenth of 1% fluctuation in prize payout reduced would be much greater than fighting with our retail establishments over a much greater increase. Mm-hmm. And so I'd be very interested in knowing what that elasticity is. Not just, we manage it closely and we look at it. I'd like to look at the numbers and know if we fluctuated by a certain percentage, what does that mean in terms of revenue?
As Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, we can certainly work with you on this. It is more complex than that because if you talk about changing the programming of a game, now you're talking about a huge capital outlay to accomplish that. That is why when you implement a game, that is something that you have to look at, and that's why it becomes a very important decision point for line games. If we're going to go back into video poker, however, and redistribute that, then you're talking about every manufacturer reprogramming this particular game, the cost that we would have, the need to implement and install that game in all of our machines. And then you have to wait and see, are the players going to notice a difference? And does that impact sales? So that's all of the complexity of it. It certainly is a very important point when you implement a new game. And that's why we're looking at a couple of different options for that right now.
Thank you, Coach Ergo. Very, very good point, and I didn't consider that. Let me ask a follow-up question then. Would it make sense for the state of Oregon then to develop a plan that looked over a course of time and looked at the depreciation of those pieces of equipment and then over a course of time looked at that prize elasticity and modified those pieces of equipment to adjust to this new strategy? To me it seems like we're trying to unjustly put something on our retailers who truly, truly do rely on that compensation to make debt service payments, to make payroll, to pay their utilities, to pay their vendors. And while while I personally am opposed to the lottery, I'll say that, I'm not naive enough to think that our retailers are not very dependent upon it.
Yeah.
And so I think that's something we need to watch closely.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, yes, that's an important factor, and we understand that, and particularly in the video product because of the numbers involved. That's why we're trying to look at that closely, but certainly we will.
Ms. Penn, just real quickly, on the decision by the commission for the line games, how then, I guess, would the March forecast, revenue forecast that Mr. Potowski's group develops, would fall into, I guess, that decision? Are we going to, is that all subject to a final decision on the negotiations with the retailers, or are you going to be able to work with them on coming up with a number that we can use in the March forecast?
Well, Mr. Chair, that is one reason I requested the commission to make a decision next week at their first meeting on whether or not line games are authorized, because you have so much planning that's necessary and then to be able to give figures to the legislature. Yes, we are working with their office, and obviously if the vote was no on Wednesday, well, then it's very simple. If the vote is yes, then we have a lot of work to do, including that rulemaking process and trying to bring retailers, who are our sales network for this product, along, and we need to have them enthusiastically promoting this product if we expect it to generate the sales that we've seen here, we project. So, but yes, we'll be working on that process with them and hope to be able to give you as solid as numbers we can for March.
So I guess and knowing that revenue forecast is, I mean, they're working on it almost to the day of making it public, that as long as, I guess, you're seeing progress with the negotiations, if they've not been concluded by that at that point, then we'd probably be looking at adopting a number in the March forecast, or do you feel that we've got to wait to have those negotiations concluded before a number is put into the forecast?
Well, Mr. Chair, I can give you my hope and my goal, and that is I would like to have this resolved as much as possible in the month of March, and that certainly would be the time of rulemaking, and I believe it's doable. It certainly is controversial, and it's not something that anyone is happy about. I'm kind of in the middle of a variety of different forces, as you are, as Ways and Means Committee. But I believe it is doable, and I think that we can give you a good number. And first of all, I would say, and I might jump to page 10 of our information here, because I've tried to address at least some of those issues about the forecast. I know there was concerns about what is the jump between the forecast from 2 years ago and the forecast here. And part of that is that the $120 million is in this $933 million figure for the lottery. However, the reason it looked like such a big jump just from standard operations without counting line games is that that was a forecast figure that was old. And in actuality, we will transfer $770 million this biennium. So the growth is 770 to 813, and that's consistent with the forecast that you just heard. So, but then 813 is added 120 million, which is to concentrate only on line games, not economic factors, but only on line games. What would be the result? So I've tried to say on page 10 here, and we've got it up on the board here, just to explain that difference for you. So how was this 120 arrived at? Because I know that's been asked a lot. We did look at other jurisdictions, even though we couldn't say there is anyone that is an exact duplicate for Oregon. And so we had a range, and we had a range of basically $50 million to $170 million per biennium. But then you try to break that down. We looked at one state that we thought could give us a little bit of guidance, West Virginia. West Virginia is not as large as Oregon, but if you look at per capita, you look at dollars available to be spent, and they in fact have a video network. They also have casinos. But if we split off the video network and just compare our video network to their video network, we look at the income available and how much is spent in a video network in both states. What we see, the only distinction we see between those two networks, is they are running line games, we are not. And what we see is the potential there in comparison of a 17% growth. We look at that and say that's the outside number. Then we tried to come back and say, let's put this in real terms. If you're talking about increase in sales, because clearly survey data, the experience of every other jurisdiction that used line games, you saw an increase. The difficulty is for us to be able to say what is the precise increase. But what we would need to do, if we capture any sales increase from line games, is we would need to see a 10 to 11% growth in sales of the video product to accomplish the $120 million figure. We believe that is obtainable. Now, there are some conditions. We need to have our retailer network on board. We need to be ready to go in July. But those, I think, are very doable. And but that puts it a little more in perspective rather than just this $120 million out there.
Okay, but what it doesn't give me, I guess, is a definitive answer on how we're going to be seeing this. I mean, I guess I'm just looking for the answer to whether we have to have those negotiations concluded before that goes into the revenue forecast, or you can make an estimate with the cooperation of Mr. Petoskey's group.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, we certainly would do our best, and it would be my goal to try to have something that is as concrete as possible Obviously, that is predicting out in the future for me, and I don't know the complexities if I will be able to have it all resolved at the time of the March forecast. We would certainly do that and try to have it be a goal that if we're a couple of weeks behind that, you would have that information as soon as possible. I'm certainly open to doing whatever I could.
Okay. Tom Patowski, would you mind just coming forward a minute to address this for us? I didn't mean to displace you there,
no.
Ben, but I guess just for purposes of making your decisions for the forecast, the March forecast, what are you looking for from the lottery?
Mr. Chair, what we'll be looking for is the best sense that we can get as to likely outcome. There still may be in negotiations on commission rates. But we'd have to see what is the best that we think may happen. And maybe the best we can do is possibly get at that point, given how negotiations are going, if it's not concluded. And by the way, the March forecast is scheduled to be released, I think, February 25th, the last Friday of the month. So what we would do is, I think at that point, we would put in probably a special section on this in our forecast, talking about the various risks and so on, given the state that the negotiations are up to that point, and any other factors that we've been able to glean through working with lottery. We're working with LRO on this also, our own office in investigating, and what we think estimates are being. So you'll get a kind of an update on the March forecast, and what we hope then is by the all-important May 15th forecast, which is the one that sets the close of session limit that you're able to spend, that then we'll have a lot further along on the conclusions of how far we're going along on this. But we know that, you know, I don't think we have any question about whether it's current law or not in terms of putting it in the forecast. The commission has the capability to do this, and thus we will still need to take a prospective look, like we do on our other forecast items, of what's our most likely outcome of what we believe is going to happen, in consultation with all the interested parties that we work with, like LRO and the lottery.
Okay, thank you. Senator Morissette, yeah, I'll let you go back to Mr. Penn.
Mr. Penn, could you give us whatever detail you can come up with on how you deal with the losers in the lottery?
Yes.
Referring to the gambling addiction treatment program. You don't have to talk about that now. I would just like to know what your board, how you consider this.
Yes.
If there's any forecast information. So.
Yes.
I don't expect a lot of it. I don't expect it to take the time now. We're almost out of time.
Okay. I'll be happy to speak with you. Okay. Certainly.
Senator Schrader. Again, we're running out of time, but it would be helpful for the subcommittee when they look at this. Two aspects. One is that as the lottery assesses expenses to various retailers, I'd like to have the subcommittee delve into that and you'd be prepared to respond in some conversations with some of my retailers, the amount of time and effort that's spent in maintaining that terminal by the lottery doesn't seem to match up with what they consider their expectations or what they would expect that to be like. So I think that'll be an issue for some members and during the discussion. The other is just a quick comment looking at performance measures. I would hope the subcommittee would focus on, you know, numbers 1, 2, 7, and 8, those that deal with, you know, your net profit, the amount transferred to the state, the problem gambler seeking treatment and administration expenses. So hopefully be prepared, I would assume, to discuss those as major outcomes, not just outputs, but major outcomes that we would expect. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just simply, again, on this issue of sales increase, I've added this chart just to show you the history of the video product and to note that there have been some changes in games and we have seen increases in revenue for that. And line games is something that we understand and clearly from talking to players and surveys and other ways that this will have a positive impact. And lastly, I simply say the lottery is celebrating its 20th year. this year. And during that 20 years, you've seen $4 billion transferred to the state to assist in these areas that the voters have requested assistance in. At the present growth of the lottery, this $4 billion will change to be, in effect, $1 billion each biennium very quickly. And so you've seen tremendous growth in this, and I think to the benefit of the people of Oregon. Appreciate your time. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to respond to them. And
Senator Nelson.
Just a quick, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. If you're paying out about 4%, state's going to need 4% of the total sales, and it's $293 million, the gross sales have to be in the $7 billion? Is that, I mean, are we talking about $7 billion that people are spending on lottery money?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, we're talking about a $9 billion sales.
Incredible.
Per year.
I can't count that.
Senator Devlin.
Just a clarification on that. When you talk about Ms. Sen, you've only been in this position for a few months, so you've obviously become a very prodigious learner in gambling operations. part of the money going through is the turn-in system,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, for instance, here when you do a video lottery and you show, I think something like 93% as prizes, it's the money going through and through and through.
Yeah.
The reality is that people, regular lottery, you have one action and you get it back. This, you put money back, you win, you get more, you play again, you win again. Ultimately, you probably lose. But the amount of dollars going through is going through again over and over and over again.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Devlin, you're better in your analysis of the gambling than me. That's correct. The turn is a phrase that I've learned a lot about. But.
Yeah.
All right. Nothing further? Then we are adjourned.
Thank you.